So it's May 24th, Vallecitos, going to the woods retreat. And this is Peter Williams. And our talk tonight is entitled, So Spiritual, an Animal. Parentheses, dissolving our separation with nature, from nature. I just want to give you a little reward for all your efforts, all your hard efforts, and throw in a little humor. So, just some collection of Buddhist jokes. This is when, remember when I said I throw you a little wisdom-tainment? So, one Buddhist monk is saying to another, I've never met anyone so thoughtless in my life. Keep up the good work. Thank you, Master. And this is by P.B. Law, Buddhist Truth in Advertising, before frumpy guy, after really cut buff guy with a spiky hairdo, after that, a very dumpy, very old man. A couple having a Buddhist argument. The woman is saying to the man who's sitting in full lotus on the floor, can you be in the moment later? And two women jogging along with weights in really good running posture in step, and one saying to the other, if you really had to choose, which would it be, enlightenment or buns of steel? So our Buddhist practice isn't all just dig in, be patient, you know, effort, etc. You know, practice ultimately is all about joy, but the Buddha did not settle for kind of joy light, L-I-T-E. He's really going for the big joy, the one that's peace, the one where we're just completely quiet and at ease and okay with life. And it takes hard work for the big joy. So, again, we want to brighten the heart, gladden the heart, lighten the mind, and I always like humor. You know, the joke goes, if I weren't laughing, I'd be crying, right? So I want to address practicing in nature tonight. And I want to talk about this illusion of separateness from nature. And if there's time, to go into a little bit of guided imagining, maybe about like a better myth for who we really are than a lot of the ways we limit ourselves with our myths, more of a sacred myth. So what we're doing by practicing in nature actually is reclaiming the roots of the tradition. I mean, the Buddha went out into the woods, you know, when he decided that he was devoting his life entirely to awakening. And he sat under a tree after many years of various kinds of practices that fell short of that, you know, total peace that he was seeking in happiness. And after years of trying different things that didn't work, he finally sat under a tree and resolved not to get up until he got enlightened. How about that for a meditative intention for your sit? I'll sit here until I get enlightened. And, you know, the quote is something along the lines of, till my bones rot and my sinews dry, and you know, I will not leave this spot. I mean, and the tradition says that there was lifetimes of merit and understanding and generosity and wisdom behind his resolve when he sat down. So I think he had a pretty good hunch he was going to get enlightened, you know, that night. So, but he sat under a tree, and his first teaching he gave in Deer Park to a bunch of other ascetics practicing in the woods. And then in the Pali Canon, you hear about Jetta's Grove and Annapindika's Grove and this and that, and the 3-month retreat that monastics do is called a rains retreat, because in India the rainy time was just a really bad time for a monk to wander around in the woods. So instead of wandering in the woods, they stayed put in the woods, or a nun. So, but they're in the woods. So going to the woods is basically like reclaiming the roots of the tradition. So we love teaching nature-based retreats. And so the tradition of Buddhist literature, you see this. So much of the literature is people, you know, in their senses, outside, you know, enjoying their experience. So the haiku tradition in Japan comes out of Zen practice, and in very simple words, trying to capture, you know, deep experiences of what the Zen tradition calls suchness, where, you know, you're dropped into your senses and there isn't this veil of separation. So a famous haiku from Basho, just very simple, just hear the sensory depth here. The old pond, a frog jumps in. Plop. That's it. That is a very awake, settled mind. Crystal clear. Can you just hear that plop as the frog jumps in? And Basho has another haiku, one of my favorites. He writes, even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoo's cry, I long for Kyoto. Do you get it? Some of you looking a little quizzical. The cry of the cuckoo evokes such like a depth of feeling in him that he's just dying to be in Kyoto, even though he's already there. Have you ever had that experience? You know? You're on the beach, everything's so perfect, you just so want to be on the beach. Because in a way, there's something almost ungraspable, you know, about these times. Sometimes, you know, I see so much beauty in nature, I just ache. Because I want to just grasp it and grab it and have it. And I know, you know, that glimmer of orange and the gilded clouds in the sunset where there's just this, you know, gold sort of border to clouds. I know it's going to go. So it can create like an ache. So anyway, this is, you know, our tradition is nature-based. The Thai forest tradition, Buddhism, monastic Buddhism in Asia, as cultures get modernized, is really getting corrupted. And monks and nuns aren't following the Vinaya. People are doing it just to get out of not having to work. And there's that side of it, and that's often in the city. And this started happening a while ago. In the 20th century, the Thai forest tradition revitalized meditation in the monasteries in the early 20th century, and they went back to the woods. And the Thai forest tradition now, if you go to Thailand and you go to Bangkok, you know, you're not going to find like the pure monks and nuns. You have to go out more into the forest to find people practicing traditional Buddhism, you know, where there's really a lot of meditation happening. So our tradition is very at home here in the woods. And when we're in the woods, there's just so much to learn. When we start paying attention the way we are, we learn a lot. And the first thing for me that always happens when I'm in nature, which I forget about, is I basically call it's the landscape of no comment. The landscape of simplicity. Everything out there, it's not clawing at us for our attention or with comments or making a big deal out of things. It just is. It's simple. Thank God. If your mind is anything like mine, it's complicated. So going to simple places is very important for our complicated minds. You know, I mean, for us, right, we see the way the aspen trees, you know, are just bursting today. Like it's when the light catches it right, it's like all this popcorn or something, you know, wasabi popcorn, you know, because it's sort of green, you know, like out there in the woods. It's just like, you know, and that's me, right? I'm doing the big deal, but the trees are just like, boom. Yeah, this is what we do. The conditions are right, so here we go. Right? It's simple. It's just the mind of no comment. And if you've watched Birds at the Feeder, you know, you may notice there's a hierarchy, there's a pecking order. In ornithology, there's even, I think, a term for it, something like perch hopping or perch jumping or something, where a bigger bird will come along. And just because he can, he lands right where a smaller bird is perched. And the smaller bird always flies away, and then the bigger bird pops down. So the low end of the pecking order is the pine siskins, the little tiny birds. And in the bird world, we call that LBJs, little brown jobs. And then slightly bigger are the house finches. And they'll, like, perch, scare, whatever the word is, you know, off the siskins, and then the bigger black-headed grosbeaks will come along and they'll do the same thing. You just watch, you'll see. And then the red-winged blackbird is sort of like the, you know, the badass. Nothing seems to, you know, scare that bird away. He's scaring, or she, the other birds away. So, and that's kind of life and death, I mean, in a way. It's like, hey, they're trying to eat. You know, this isn't just like playing hopscotch or whatever. I mean, this is survival. And still, you know, it's just like, okay, so that happens. You know, the pine siskin just flies away to another branch, and it's like, okay, you know, I'm good. You know, I mean, there's just this mind of no comment. And I just love, you know, really taking that in. There's just no... That line I love so much from the Wendell Berry poem that Mary read. When we're in nature, we're around everything which does not tax its lives with forethought of grief. I think we're the only ones who do that. We have forethought of grief. We anticipate, you know, the remorse over the past. So, and the Buddha had a very simple teaching, you could say, in a way, that's really the difference maybe between humans and animals. And it's the teaching of the two arrows, and that when we have an unpleasant experience, the Buddha said, that could be, you know, in this analogy, the first arrow. But then we shoot ourselves with another arrow, which is the reaction to having an unpleasant experience. And the Buddha says, we go into sorrow, grief, lamentation, and beat our breasts over some unpleasant experience arising. And he said, that reactivity is like a second arrow. And so you may have heard this little tagline in Buddhism, but pain is unavoidable. Suffering is optional. So the reactivity is optional. And our awakening, more our freedom that we get from meditation, is never about getting away from pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. The Buddha boiled down all experiences into these three qualities. So our thoughts are either pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Sound, sensations, or taste. It's always going to have one of these three flavors. And we never get out of that. That's not what awakening does. We don't stop that dance. But what we can find is real peace with it. We can actually be okay in an unpleasant experience. And we can be in a state of enjoyment, but wise enjoyment in a pleasant experience, knowing that, you know, not everything or nothing lasts. So we can enjoy it while it lasts. William Blake has a line, "Kiss the joy as it flies." That's the way to relate wisely to pleasure. The joy is flying. So we can kiss it. We can enjoy it. But we know, you know, it's moving. But we can really appreciate it when it happens. So that's not a second arrow. But a second arrow is when we really are in some reaction. And really, that basically means we're not mindful. When we're mindful, we cut reaction. And when we lose mindfulness, it's likely we'll go into reaction when faced with some kind of difficulty. So, nature's a place where it's just one arrow. It's just the unavoidable pain and pleasure of life without comment. And there's something about that that can really, if we just tune into it, we see the simplicity of how animals are living and trees and rocks and sky. You know, it's like nature is kind of soothing us if we're willing to tune in. It's like nature is a people whisperer. You know, it can kind of whisper us and quiet us down. So the second arrow is, if we could just leave it at second arrow, you know, that would be pretty darn good, right? But when there's 193 inside of us, ouch! Human pincushions here. You know, it's our thinking mind that generates all the arrows, all the extra arrows. And it's ironic because our thinking mind is so helpful and so useful, and we can cause so much benefit through thinking about how we can better things, you know. And yet, thinking causes most of our problems. I saw a spiritual teacher, Byron Katie, speak once, and she had done a lot of work with torture survivors. And even at that level, the second arrow for them was worse than the first arrow. And probably real arrows. You know, she said to a person what torturers, people who had been tortured, told her was what was worse than the torture itself was the fear of the torture. I mean, that's pretty heavy. are again taxing our lives with forethought of grief. So this is why Mark Twain said something along the lines, "The worst things in my life never happened." Have you had that experience? In psychology, we have a term for it, catastrophizing. You know, that we spin catastrophes out of, you know, imagining things. And then they just don't happen often. But our fear of things, you know, we add so many layers of unnecessary suffering. I could say understandable suffering. Like, of course we do this. You know, we don't really have an alternative until we really know one. So, of course we do it. And this is not to beat up on ourselves or judge ourselves. It's to get that actually there's some things we do that we can really, you know, kind of tame and feel a lot happier in the process. So a poem that to me just captures this flavor of nature kind of people whispering us. It's called The Little Duck. And it's by Donald Babcock, published in The New Yorker in 1947. The Little Duck. Now we are ready to look at something pretty special. It's a duck riding the ocean 100 feet beyond the surf. No, it isn't a gull. A gull always has a raucous touch about him. There is a great heaving in the Atlantic, and he is part of it. He looks a little like a mandarin, or the Lord Buddha, meditating under the bow tree. Probably he doesn't know how large the ocean is, and neither do you. But he realizes it. And what does he do, I ask you? He sits down in it. He reposes in the immediate, as if it were infinity, which it is. That is religion, and the duck has it. He has made himself a part of the boundless by easing himself into it, just where it touches him. I like the little duck. He doesn't know much, but he has religion. So the no comment, the quieting, the way nature can quiet us. Some of you talked about watching clouds, you know, dissolve and form. You know, others of you have mentioned just simple experiences of just listening to the river, or, you know, maybe today just opening to the space of, you know, when we're sitting on Icarus Point. You know, we're all tasting glimpses of getting whispered by nature. And so when nature helps us quiet down in combination with our meditation, sometimes we can get glimpses into a second lesson, and that's the lesson of non-separation. When our mind is quiet and not clouded by thinking, non-separation is obvious. And let me use the positive word, belonging. When our mind is quiet, we just belong. The question, what is the meaning of life, has no relevance when the mind is quiet. We aren't seeking anymore when the mind is quiet. We just are, and actually that's all we need. And it's a beautiful state when our mind can quiet down. Now again, not to set up striving, because we can't force the mind to quiet. We can meditate. And some of you have talked about, you know, just kind of grace coming where the mind really does quiet, you know, for a time, you know, just a minute or two, or maybe a little longer. And you actually really realize this. Right, I just am. And that's all I need. Nothing else needed. So when our mind quiets, there's a deep fellowship, a deep sense of belonging that's just there, unfabricated. This is the kind of joy that the Buddha wants us to taste and understand more deeply. And the Tibetans have a term for it, natural great peace. And in some way, when you have some kind of experience like this, you know that's what you're really after. All of our activity, everything we do, when we finally taste even just a few moments of deep belonging, we know, like, yes, that's it. That is super, super important to me. So a little more poetry to illuminate all this. So Li Po, 8th century Chinese poet, writes about this kind of non-separation or belonging. He wrote, "The birds have vanished into the sky, and now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and me, until only the mountain remains." Delicious, right? Yum. So let nature help you. You know, your effort and your patience is helping you, and so is being in nature and opening to the natural world. And just to pull it into the Western tradition, here's something along similar vein from Rilke. He wrote, "Not to be cut off, not through the slightest partition, shut out from the law of the stars. The inner, what is it, if not intensified sky, hurled through with birds, and deep with the winds of homecoming." That's the non-separation, you know, I was trying to just help spur us into up there on Icarus Point for those of us who went. So this is the promise, the possibility, the potential of our practice. And again, we can never force it. We can only just do the practice, and then sometimes moments like that come with grace, as grace. They just happen. We can't control them staying. We didn't ask them to come, but they come the more we practice. So my grandfather, one of his favorite sayings was, "The harder I work, the better luck I have." It's kind of the same idea. You know, these things happening are accidental, but practice makes us accident prone. So, one way into, you know, a deeper sense of belonging or non-separation, just a simple way that we can all do a lot, is just relax. You know, relaxing helps. So, you know, the softening of the body is important. And as I always instruct, in the meditation, and you might just want to do it now. Let your eyes soften, and your brow, and your tongue, and throat, and shoulders. And then if it feels okay, bring to mind just a very slight difficulty that you've had on retreat. Not your big, big one, or even a medium one, but just something slight. Some little that happened. And notice the thought, notice the image, notice if there's any response in the body as you just think of this little difficulty. And now just relax. Don't try to let go of it, just relax. And notice breath or something else. In a way, this is what we're trying to do over and over and over, is relax. Our thoughts stir us up into so much tension. And the more we can relax, you know, the more we just can sort of be at ease and back into, you know, a deeper sense of belonging or fulfillment or satisfaction. And I was really struck by this on a retreat once where a monk from the Thai forest tradition, I don't even remember what the whole rest of his talk was about, but I remember this one line. You know, he said something along the lines, he was talking about the natural ease and peace in the mind. And if we can just relax, you know, a lot gets taken care of. And then he punctuated it by saying, all your difficulty takes energy to maintain. It really takes energy to kind of stir the pot so much and ruminate and obsess and, you know, run through the same thing over and over. This is not about blaming yourself for doing that, but it's actually, we can start to have an insight when our mind quiets that, oh, right, it really does take energy. And I don't have to do it. I can just give myself to my practice and just see what happens if I don't bite. And don't try to analyze that little problem I stumbled across or this little quirk of my personality that I don't like. And don't sort of try to figure out how I can not do that next time. Just let go and relax. And this is the experiment this week, right? It's actually to see, is that really going to help? Try it. Put it to the test and see. Just keep going. Keep letting go. Keep relaxing. Don't try to fix anything, change anything, solve anything, figure anything out. And see if you turn into a mindless ninny or something much better. Just see. So when we let go like this, we do taste a lot more relaxation and belonging. And that's just a sense of non-separation. And then it's not my pain or your pain, but the pain. We can hear someone crying in the hall, and we can hold it in compassion because our hearts naturally don't create a separation or barrier. You know, we can just hear that, oh, someone's in pain. Oh, you know, may they be free of their difficulty, whatever it is. And then, but really our hearts, even that language is a little dualistic because it's her over there or him over there. It's just like, may there be less suffering. And we can, our hearts very naturally are empathic and resonate, you know, when we're not getting in the way of it. And so when we really get clear, we realize we're not separate, not from each other, not from nature. And, you know, we think we're so special because we're human over here and nature's over there. And it's BS. We are all natural, 100% organic. Everything about us, you know, even building this world of internet and hyper-connectivity and hyper, you know, like every, you know, the whole world throbbing at you in your palm, in your phone. That is coming straight out of nature, and we make some separate division, you know. And in some ways it's useful because we humans, you know, are doing so much to destroy everything that isn't nature. But then by doing that, we're destroying ourselves too. So, you know, we are nature. So we quiet down in nature. As we quiet down, we may have a deeper sense of belonging and fulfillment. Nature also teaches us how to relate to change, chaos, unpredictability, that we can't control. I mean, anything can happen at any time. You know, those Oklahoma tornado that just happened before retreat. I'm from Oklahoma, and my mom just flew into Tulsa from being with my brother in Washington, D.C., and she just landed in Tulsa, which is 100 miles away. But, I mean, you know, that just came out of nowhere. So nature can be like this, and then it can have sudden, shocking surprises. So, in a way, we just never quite know. We have some basic ideas. Isn't it kind of nice this week to not know a weather report? Just not know what's like. I mean, we're this little tiny bowl. We just have no idea, you know, what's on the other side. We just have to wait for it to sort of like come into our little world. And, you know, it's really different than our normal life. And this is the thing. We just never know about weather. You know, was that rain today going to like coalesce into something bigger or just be a few drops? And, well, it was only a few drops, so who knows? We know we need the rain, but we just have no idea. I remember as a kid, you know, having gone to Sunday school a lot, and whenever there was like big, long rains, I would get really scared that it was going to last 40 days and 40 nights. I guess at that age I wasn't tuning into, well, I could just turn on the weather report, you know. But we just don't know. And that's actually, you know, weather has a lot to teach us about ourselves. We often just don't know how long something's going to last. We might be really scared it's going to last 40 days and 40 nights. Some experience we're having that pushes us right to our edge, and there's some kind of difficulty that we just don't want to face because it's really scary, because we don't know what's going to happen. But for many things, if you don't like the weather, just wait a minute, right? You notice this. Have you noticed this in your experience that things are changing all day long? You know, you had a great sit in the morning. Your mind went totally quiet for a little while. And then the next sit, you came in and sat down. And you were here for like 35 minutes before you even realized you were here in the meditation hall. We can have these meditation experiences that are really, really nice and pleasant. And they really give us a glimpse of the potential. But we can't control them sticking around. All of our experiences are like weather. Weather has a lot to teach us. Weather is a thing. It's happening, you know. We have to work with it. but we don't take it personally, right? Though Sharon Salzberg sometimes on retreat tells stories about how she goes on vacation and it's crappy weather and she blames herself. My honeymoon with my sweetie was, we went to Mexico in January and it rained for a week, and it was very sad, actually. The ocean was full of plastic trash. It was horrible. Horrible. And we were really happy to be with each other, and it was sort of comical, but, you know, we had a bad time, but we didn't have the second arrow of blaming ourselves for it, you know? At least. But sometimes we do, and... but here's the thing. Would you blame yourself for something that was not in your control? Like, does that make sense? Pardon?
No, but you do it anyway.
Yeah, no, but you do it anyway. So, yes, we do. So a wise friend of mine said, the less I practice, the more in control I think I am. When we practice, we start seeing a lot is out of our control. And rather than that being some kind of threat or assault, we're psyched. Oh, if it's not in my control, then my self-judgment doesn't have any business latching on. Oh, what a relief. Oh, there I go again. Right, right. But no. I didn't decide to order that up and get irritated, you know. I didn't stand in a lunch line that was taking too long and say, huh, so what's the right reaction here? Is it joy? Is it curiosity? Is it, you know, fear? Impatience, right. Okay, let's be impatient. We don't do that. Actually, we wake up in the middle of a reaction. It came out of our control. So to actually say, what's my problem? I'm here on a retreat and I'm getting impatient. My God, I can't believe this. I've been meditating 3 days and I'm impatient over this. My practice isn't working. I'm a bad meditator. Blah, blah, blah. Right? If you didn't order it up, how can you blame yourself for it? It's like blaming the weather. It's a relief to watch your reactions be out of your control. Now, don't get me wrong. We do have some control. But it's very specific. The only control we have is how we respond to the moment to which we just awoke. That's the moment when we can say, oh, let me be with this. Or we can say, I can't believe this, blah, 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 blah. That's the moment when we have control. And when we start realizing this, we start really paying attention to the present. And we start really being kind to ourselves for all our little foibles and flaws that we didn't order up, but are just happening because of habit. These are habitual conditioned responses. When we don't decide to have an emotion, what's deciding it? Habit. Conditions. So we start to be a lot kinder. And it's like, oh, there I go again. And it's kind of like you're more of a little cartoon character to yourself as opposed to it's a big deal, heavy weight. I can't believe I had that reaction. It's like, oh yeah, that one. So, let's make this real and experiential rather than theoretical. We're going to just pay attention just for a minute to our body sensations. So, if you would, just check in. Tuning into whatever sensation your attention just naturally goes to. And just reflecting, huh, did I willfully put this sensation here? Or is it just here, the way a cloud is in the sky? If you notice the sensation changing, or maybe you notice just some sensation, just a quick little blip of something, just reflect, who made that happen? Now let your attention take in the whole field of sensation of the body at once. You could almost imagine just sort of being aware just next to yourself, sort of feeling into this whole body, this whole field of sensation. And notice, is there change in sensation as you feel full body? If there's change, just notice, does that happen on its own, or are you willing it? And then we can just stop. So it's obvious, right? We're not in control of our sensations. They come and go by themselves. We can shift our posture, and that'll create some new sensations, and then those sensations will come and go by themselves. So it's not like we don't have control, but we have that very specific control that I mentioned, how we respond in the present moment. That's all we can do. The rest happens on its own. Sensations come and go just like clouds. And let's take this to another level. Another little exercise here. I'm going to say something and just watch the process of mind that happens. So just notice the first word that pops into your head when I say a word. And notice the process of how it happens. Okay? Was that clear? You really focus on the process. Just watch your mind respond to the word that I say. Watch what word comes in response. Ready? Marco. And again, now watch your process. Watch what word comes when I say this one. Ready? Basket. And now I'll say another one. The rolling. Okay. So is it something like polo case stones or something else? Polo what? What else? Ball, hills. Now, if this were 1950 and the same process was done and other people were sitting here, there might be completely different words coming. But did you notice the process? Did you sit there and say, oh, he said Marco. Oh, right, I remember I played a childhood game in the pool. The right response is polo. Or did just polo come out? Right? Okay. Just polo. Isn't that kind of weird? That thought just sort of happened automatically? Okay, now here's the dirty little secret. when your mind gets really quiet and you start noticing your thoughts, you will notice your mind Marco Poloing in a very fancy disguised way. But it's one thought pinballing after another. Over, you know, pinballing, what's the word? Against another. Yeah. Just, we have a thought, you know, I say New Zealand. What comes into your mind? I want to go there someday. Or, you know, I don't know, Kiwi. Whatever. You know, I say mom. What thought comes into your mind? Dad. So this is at a very simple level, but it's this all gets disguised by our complex thinking. But we often are just thinking in this very free form, free association sort of way. Do you notice this? That your mind just pinballs over a lot of different terrain in your life in a very short time when you're practicing. So, and we can come in and exercise control over our thoughts, you know, and direct our thoughts along a certain line. But a lot of our thinking is just pinballing. It's just Marco Polo, very sophisticated. So the more we see that, and we see that our thoughts are often just, the brain's just pumping out thoughts, because that's what it does. The heart pumps blood, the brain pumps thoughts. Thank you, brain. Good job. Good job. You know? It's very, very good at that job, right? But when we see that it's just a lot of stuff just getting pumped out, we don't take it so seriously. We're lighter about it. And again, we're having this insight that it's not so in our control. And so we relax more. And we can treat our mind a little more like weather, you know. Yeah, sometimes we want to jump in and put on the raincoat and to, you know, deal with the weather. So, and sometimes we want to jump into our mind and say, nope, not going there. Or yeah, more of that, or whatever. But a lot of times it's just weather. It's just the brain doing what the brain does. It's kind of impersonal. Again, we feel good. We start relaxing more when we start having insights like this. It's not my fault so much, you know? And we take ourselves really personally. Nature helps us, you know, take it less personally. We take it personally that we age. A good friend of mine said, I think I'm going to need bifocals. It's embarrassing. It's like, oh yeah, well, you are 50, you know, like it's his fault, right? And it's like, these bodies are just nature. They're just aging, you know? Did you decide, you know, if you have gray hairs, when that was going to happen? No, it was nature deciding. It was your body deciding for you. Did you decide how tall you were going to grow to be? Of course not. Did you decide what hair color you were going to have when you came out? Of course not. We are nature. And it's a relief. It's out of our control, and that's good news. A lot of it, we can just relax. There's a whole lot of weather happening. You know? Okay. Sure, put on a raincoat when you need to. Otherwise, no big deal. So the second part of the talk is really just getting it, how natural we are and how 100% organic. So when we think about animals, if you have a pet, bring your pet to mind. Or if you have an animal that you have known, or someone else's pet, you know, or in a wild animal you've seen, and really bring to mind that quality of no comment. I think one of the reasons we love having animals around is there's a way in which they people whisper us too. So our kitty, Stella, you know, she, to me, you know, when she's just sort of sitting there purring in her eyes or sort of closing and opening, I swear she's people whispering us. She is just telling Lisa and I, it's okay, no big deal, no, just relax, what's the big fuss over here? So animals are very in the moment. But the Buddha said animals are mindful in the way people are mindful. So them being very in the moment is very helpful to us. But that they're sort of a slave to their passions. They don't have this kind of mindfulness that can say, oh, squirrel over there, desire over here, unskillful act, maybe not. It's just boom, right? Very in the present, very in the now, but not a lot of mindfulness. So another analogy is if you're in a movie, you know, and you're really gripped by it, you're very present. You're not thinking about past or future or your bank account, or right? But you can be not mindful at all. Being present is not the same thing as being mindful. We have to be present to be mindful, but there's this extra piece of knowing what's happening. I know I'm listening right now. Yeah, it's this self-awareness. And so I was teaching a class in college once about the interface of science and Buddhism. It was a really fun class to teach. And I was talking about this teaching and of the Buddhas that, you know, that animals really are sort of slaves to their passions. And this person looked so crestfallen, this really sweet 18-year-old, and she said, but I thought my dog was enlightened. It was so cute, but I had popped her bubble in some way. So we are animalistic, and we have all these passions and greed, aversion, and delusion, but we're spiritual animals. You know, we have this yearning inside of us to really be really truly at peace. But it's not a peace that's enslaved to our passions. It's a peace that's discriminating about what passions to follow and what not. So it's like we're a black bear in many ways, but we're one that wants to get enlightened. I don't know if that urge is in a black bear. I don't think so. I don't really know, but so there's many ways to understand how natural we are. So much of us is a product of evolution. Assuming you subscribe to the scientific viewpoint, not everyone does, but I'll take that risk. Are you hard on yourself? Are you hard on others? Do you tend to focus on the negative? Guess what? That means you're human, because it's a negativity bias of the human brain. We register and store and recall negative information much more quickly than positive. It's built into our brain. The theory is that, you know, the people that were so chill, it's all good, they became tiger food. Whereas the neurotic, anxious people like us are like, what was that? You know? And if it was nothing, no, nothing lost. But if it was something, then we got the hell out, and we went on and had babies. That's the theory, anyway. So, you know, it's all natural, our negativity bias. We need to consciously work against it and focus on the positive and count our blessings. and be grateful. We have to work against it. Have you heard about the triune brain, the three-part brain? Our brain is just a product of evolution. So the brain stem, you know, if you sort of feel the back of your head, where the spine meets the skull, that's the brain stem. That's the reptilian brain. We share that in common with reptiles. And it controls all of our functions, automatic ones, like thirst and hunger and breath and heartbeat and this kind of stuff. And then midbrain is the mammalian brain, and this is where our emotions reside. And then frontal brain is primate brain. And then in the very front is neocortex, and that's really kind of the human part of our brain. But Wes Nisker, Dharma teacher, says there's a lizard in us and there's a lemur in us, you know? And we have very animalistic history just embedded in our brain. We're so natural that we're only 10% us. We're actually 90% non-human by cell count, because there's 10 times more bacteria cells in our body than human cells. How's that for freaky? According to Wes Nisker, Dharma teacher, journalist, quasi-scientist, not really, there are more bacteria in your mouth right now than humans who have ever lived. Yikes. Our digestive system is so critical to have all these different bacteria. Now there's this whole probiotic craze. They're finding, the recent research is that the appendix is actually not so useless. It actually is a place where a lot of bacterial colonies get developed that are really positive for our digestion. And if we didn't have the bacteria in us, the non-human DNA, we couldn't be digesting lunch right now. So we are just riddled through with nature. We are nature. And I'm going to do kind of a short guided meditation here on all the ways that we are actually just this living museum of our past, of our evolution. So you can take a breath in and thank the history of the earth when you do. Because there was no oxygen in the atmosphere until the 2 billion years ago, when photosynthetic bacteria began photosynthesizing for the first time on Earth and excreting oxygen as a byproduct. So some of us already experienced this on the trail when I guided this. But breathe in the atmosphere and just feel oxygen coming into you, going into your lungs, into the bronchi, and then the bronchioles, and then through the bronchioles, exchange happens where the oxygen moves into our blood. At what point does the atmosphere end and do you start? At the tip of your mouth or nostrils? Halfway down your throat? Into your bronchi, I don't know how to say that right. Into the bronchioles, where it's just air. Is that you, or is that the atmosphere? Where do we start, and where does the atmosphere begin? Where does our history going back 2 billion years, and where do we start? Well, in this very breath, we're breathing in oxygen that all life eventually, when our atmosphere became saturated with oxygen, then life evolved to use it, and it was a really potent source of getting energy from things by using oxygen to oxidize things. And life took off eventually with oxidation as its, you know, a main process, main metabolic process, cellular respiration. So this will be a fairly quick journey through evolutionary history, but the mere fact that you have more than one cell in your body is really different. 700 million years ago, there was just single-celled organisms like bacteria. And our heritage goes back 700 million years to multicellular creatures evolving. And when you breathe in and feel your lungs, you can say, it's me, these are my lungs. That's true, of course. And they are also the gift of conditions 400 million years ago, when some kind of fish eventually figured out how to leave the ocean and come onto land, and we get amphibians, and the taking in of oxygen happens through lungs instead of gills. This history is us. We are not separate from it. We are the inheritors of it. And if you enjoy sex, then thank reptiles. Because 250 million years ago, internal fertilization evolved for the first time, sex in that kind of way, internal way. And then just feel the warmth of your body. You've inherited your warm-bloodedness from events in evolution 225 million years ago. That's a gift of the past. The hair on your head is a gift of the same time, mammals developing true mammalian fur. And if you would feel the coccyx, the tip of your sacrum, just below your waistline. You don't have that now because of events that unfolded 25 million years ago. And then you might feel your thumb and just rotate it a little bit. This we share with apes. And this part of you is 18 million years old. Our line didn't have these until then. And you might take the fact that you walk very personally, that you walk on two legs. Yep, this is me walking on two legs. But really what it is the fact that the plains or the forests of East Africa went through a dry spell as the weather changed 4 million years ago, and forests turned into savanna, some grassland, some trees mixed together. And monkeys came out of the trees to walk on land and walk on 2 feet eventually. So we can take that very personally, and yet we didn't do it. Evolution did it. we are nature. We are the living museum, living repository of billions of past conditions that led our evolutionary line from single cells to multi-cells, to fish, to amphibians, to reptiles, to mammals. Through and through, we're nature. We came from the earth, we'll return to the earth, we belong to the earth. Just the last little tidbit to throw in. It's a very interesting piece of evolution that our brain enlarged roughly 300,000 years ago to 200,000 years ago, started really enlarging, and nobody knows why. There's no evidence of symbolic activity until about 50,000 years ago, 40 to 50. So why did our brain enlarge? It's likely it enlarged for some other reason than language and thought, and then language and thought came along later. It's just sort of an interesting, bizarre part of evolution and part of us. So this little conceptual journey is just a way to overturn our thinking mind that always makes us separate, so we can get it that we are deeply connected to the life around us, we are deeply connected to evolutionary past and everything that's happened on this planet. All of it is still here in us and in the life around us. Past conditions still unfolding in the present. And now, just a little trick to drop all this thinking, purposeful thinking, and just come into purposeful awareness, purposeful non-thinking. Just letting go. If any of this, you know, matter to you, it'll come back to you in some way. So just feel your breath.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.